Okay, so well, let's get going. So I thought that to get us started today, I would do something a little bit different, and I would take a little time to talk about something which is not related to the main development. So I'll be returning to hypersurfaces a little bit later on in this lecture, but I want to take an opportunity. I got an email from one of you this week, and I won't say who it is in case that person would like to remain anonymous. But I got an email from somebody who asked a very interesting and I think a very good question. And it's a topic that, I think tends to fascinate people, and it's a topic that forces you to think very deeply about the principle of equivalence and what it means and what it doesn't mean. And the question was, do charged particles moving freely in a gravitational field radiate, or don't they radiate? And I wanted to talk to, I wanted to talk a little bit about that because I think it is really a fascinating topic, and I can't resist talking about it, even though it has nothing to do with, whatever we were talking about late last week. So, do charged particles radiate? And the complete question is, even if they're moving freely in curved space-time following a geodesic, can we say whether or not the charged particle radiates or not? So I won't give you a general answer right away because I don't think I can really. What I want to look at is, a sequence of simple examples where I can answer the question one way or another. But before I do that, I think we have to define what radiation means, because it turns out that a lot of people have had very emotional discussions about this, and typically they differ in points of view only because they choose different definitions for what radiation is supposed to mean. And I think we can avoid a lot of confusion by just trying to refine or, try to define what radiation is supposed to mean. And those issues arise even in flat space-time. So let's go back to something that we think we understand, radiation processes in flat space-time, and let's ask, what is the, definition of the word radiation in classical flat space-time electrodynamics? So if you're working in flat space-time and you're, looking at the motion of a charged particle in flat space-time, following Maxwell's electrodynamics, well, here's a question you can answer. And the point is that radiation is not something that you can identify locally in space-time. In order to identify whether radiation is present in the space-time, you have to be in the wave zone. So what I imagine here is that we have, a local distribution of charge somewhere, some blob of charge that's undergoing time-dependent processes. And as a result of this time-dependent process, the electromagnetic field is going to be changing in time, and radiation is going to be produced. So we have a source over here. We have a dependence on time. Of course, if we don't have a dependence on time, we don't have radiation. That's pretty clear. So we have time-dependent processes within the source. We have charges moving around. And if I want to know whether or not radiation is produced, well, I have to define what the radiation field is, and the radiation field in flat space-time electrodynamics is defined only in the wave zone. There's a distinction between the field that's going to be found in the near zone close to the source and the field that's going to be found in the wave zone far away from the source, and it's only in the wave zone far away from the source that you can call the electromagnetic field that lives there a radiation field. In the near zone, you have a time-dependent electromagnetic field, but it doesn't have the characteristics of what you would call the radiation field. And the reason is that, well, to call the radiation field radiation, it has to satisfy, well, at least two properties. It has to travel with the speed of light, so three properties. It has to travel with the speed of light. It has to fall off, the electromagnetic field has to fall off as 1/2 the distance. And on top of that, the E field and the B field has to be purely transverse to the direction of propagation. So all of those properties I take to be fundamental, notions that have to do with the radiation field. So E and B both have to be orthogonal to each other, and they each have to be orthogonal to the direction of propagation. And if you meet those three properties, you're in the wave zone and you're dealing with a radiation field. If you don't have those properties, you're not far enough away, you're too close to the near zone, and even though you might have a time-dependent electromagnetic field in the near zone, it doesn't have all of those characteristics that make the electromagnetic field truly a radiation field. So in the wave zone, you have, propagation at the speed of light. You have the transverse property of the electromagnetic field, and you also have the statement that E falls off as 1 over R, and B also falls off as 1 over R. And those are, what I would take as being features of the electromagnetic field that makes it a radiation field. In the near zone, when you're too close to the source, well, what you find is that if the source is dominated by a dipole component, if the total charge inside the source is zero, then the electric field outside the source is going to be a dipolar field that's going to fall off as 1 over R cubed, and you won't recognize the 1 over R component of the field because it's going to be way subdominant compared with the dominant field that blows up as 1 over R cubed as you approach the source. And, if you look at the field in the near zone, well, it's time dependent, but there's no notion of propagation of the speed of light. It's not something you can recognize if you're too close to the source. And the E and B fields certainly don't have transverse properties. Those properties don't exist in the near zone. They emerge gradually as you move out to the wave zone, and they become precise and they become valid to an arbitrary accuracy only essentially very close to infinity. So those properties are emerging gradually as you move into the wave zone, and they become more precise and more accurate as you move far away and approach infinity. What's the distinction between the wave zone and the near zone? Well, what you need to define that is a characteristic wavelength for the radiation. And the wave zone is going to be the region that lives far away, namely at distance that's larger than the characteristic wavelength for the radiation. So we have a time-dependent process that will have a characteristic time TC. So that's the time it takes for anything of interest to happen within the source. Corresponding to this, there's going to be a characteristic frequency that's going to be, 1 over that time scale. And then there's going to be a characteristic wavelength that's going to be, C times, it's going to be C over C times the time scale, or C divided by the characteristic frequency. And the wave zone then is going to be defined such that you're at distances that are pretty large compared with characteristic wavelengths. And it's only there in space-time that you can recognize a time-dependent electromagnetic field as being a radiation field. So the message here, and what's important for what I want to discuss next, is that while radiation is not something that can be determined everywhere, it's not, whether or not you have radiation in your space-time, it's not something that can be decided by looking at the local region that would be small compared, for example, with the scale of the wavelength or the scale of the radius of curvature. Radiation is really a global thing that you recognize only if you probe a large enough region of space-time, a region that has to be large compared with wavelength. Okay, so now we can, if we understand that, I think we're well prepared to answer some questions about what happens in flat space-time, in curved space-time. So let's look at an example. Suppose that I have a black hole over here, and suppose that I have a charge over here, and that's not going to be a freely falling charge in this example. It's going to be a charge at rest. So this is an electron with positive charge E at rest. So I just keep it there. So the question is, does that charge radiate? Let's take a poll. Who says it does? Who says it doesn't? You have to commit. So majority says it doesn't, and the majority is correct. And the majority probably would argue that, well, there's no possibility here of radiation because there's no time dependence anywhere in this situation. We have a charge at rest. We have a static space-time. There's no time dependence anywhere. How could there be radiation without the time dependence? And that's the correct answer. Where it gets confusing is when you try to mix in that statement, which is, I think, physically very clear, with the principle of equivalence. The principle of equivalence, you know, if you don't, you know, formulate it very precisely, would say something like this. Well, if I have a particle at rest in space-time, it's not freely moving. It's not freely falling under the action of gravity. It's not following a geodesic motion. And therefore, as far as we're concerned, general relativity, it's not moving. It's not defining an inertial frame. And it's, you know, following actually motion, which is accelerating. A charged particle at rest, or any particle at rest in space-time like this, has to be maintained at rest by acting on it with a force. And that particle is accelerated. That particle is not following a geodesic motion. If the particle is accelerated, then thinking about a principle of equivalence, you would think, well, if it's accelerated, it should emit radiation, because it's well known that in flat space-time, if you have accelerated motion, you have radiation. And the conclusion is false. And the conclusion is false because the principle of equivalence is something that's meant to apply only locally. If you have local acceleration, you can conclude in the existence of local forces explaining this acceleration, and so on and so forth. But, you know, the issue of whether or not you have radiation is really a global issue. And the principle of equivalence is not very useful at answering questions like that, because it doesn't, you know, allow you to probe global questions like whether or not radiation is present. So we're all clear that a particle at rest is not going to be emitting radiation. Let's talk about a particle that's now freely moving around the black hole and orbiting, say, around the black hole. So let's say that we have a particle that now, so it's still a charged particle, but instead of being at rest, it just follows normal geodesic motion around the black hole that takes it in a sort of weird orbit that, you know, could look like this. Well, here the situation is more interesting because, well, we have a time dependence. We have a time dependence and we have geodesic motion. For the charged particle, there's no other forces acting on the particle. It just follows a natural geodesic of our curved space-time. The space-time is static, but there's a time dependence certainly in the motion of the particle. So now, do we have radiation here, or don't we? Who says no radiation? Who says radiation? Okay, again, the majority says yes, and the majority is correct. But that's where the principle of equivalence can lead to actual confusion. Because according to the principle of equivalence, if we take it very seriously and we forget the fact that it's formulated only locally, this is a particle that defines an inertial frame. So a freely moving particle, a particle that's freely moving in a gravitational field, is moving in a geodesic, and the geodesic is unaccelerated, and therefore this motion that I've drawn here defines an inertial frame in space-time. It's one of those, you know, unaccelerated frames that we can attach to the motion of the particle. Well, the principle of equivalence is supposed to say something like this. If you look at the physics locally in that inertial frame, it's going to look like the physics that you would find in flat space-time. And locally, therefore, in this inertial frame, we have unaccelerated motion. And according to flat space-time, physics, unaccelerated motion should correspond to no radiation being emitted. The principle of equivalence, if you if you look at it like this and forget about the local nature of the formulation of the principle of equivalence, would perhaps lead you to believe that because you're dealing with unaccelerated motion, this is a situation where you don't emit radiation. And again, well, the majority saw through this, you know, a false argument because, well, the principle of equivalence really tells you about things that happen locally. It's only a local, certainly a local examination of what's going on. Whether or not you have radiation is something that has to be decided globally. And the way to answer the question operationally to say, okay, let's have an observer at Trinity way over here, and let's ask what this observer is actually seeing when he measures the electromagnetic field produced by the particle. And the question would be, well, is the electromagnetic field as measured by this observer, does it have all the properties that would require a radiation field to have? Is the electromagnetic field transverse? Does it propagate at the speed of light? Does it fall off as one over the distance? And all of those questions would be answered yes. So if you actually ask the right question and ask what is an observer going to measure, you know, way out there in the wave zone defined more or less along the same lines that we had before, then there's no ambiguity. There is radiation being emitted in the situation. So unaccelerated charges do radiate in curved space-time, at least sometimes, in this example it does. Accelerated charges, like the previous example, may not radiate. And so, you know, to ask the question whether charged particles do radiate or not is something that can be answered case by case when you look at the situation closely enough. But generally it can be difficult to answer because you really do need to understand the global aspects of the problem and you have to analyze the problem case by case in order to conclude. And at the beginning, of course, you have to decide what you mean by radiation. And that's something that involves some of those ideas. And more importantly, the global aspect of this problem. So any questions about that? Yes, please.
Well, if I naively, I think that the particles accelerating, and therefore I think naively it's going to radiate.
That's right.
But I would also think that it's going to carry energy away.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Therefore, the argument would then go, well, now the charged particle is losing energy, it's going to spiral in or it's going to do something, but it's not just going to follow the geodesic.
Right.
So now if I start following the particle in the local, the local free default frame,
right,
I will presumably see a deviate me, but how do I understand that? Because I just see a charge emission direct with respect to me.
Thank you. It's like a planned question. Right. I was hoping someone would ask that question because, as John points out, I mean, this is not the end of the story, because if you think those issues of
energy radiated, if you think of the issue of radiation reaction, there's more to it than that, and John described it really well. So how do we describe radiation reaction in curved space? Radiation reaction, so the general idea is this. So let's go back to flat space-time electrodynamics. We have a particle following some kind of accelerated motion in flat space-time. It will emit radiation, and there's got to be a force that's going to change. So let's look at the classic example of having. So suppose I have a proton here and an electron going around it. This is a system that, you know, forget about the quantum mechanics of this. Let's look at purely from a classical point of view. This is a system involving an accelerated charge. This is a system that emits electromagnetic waves to infinity. This is a system that loses energy. And if the system loses energy, it's got to be true that the motion of the electron is not a perfect circle, but it's going to be some spiraling motion that eventually will lead you to, to the destruction of that classical atom. And in fact, if you calculate the time scale it would take for a classical atom to disintegrate, it's something of the order of 10 minus 12 seconds. So it's the same kind of order of magnitude of the typical transition time between energy levels. What's the explanation for this? How do you account for this in classical electrodynamics? Well, what you have to think about is the fact that the electron is not only fossil, is not subjected only to the field created by the proton. If that was the only field acting on the electron, then motion would be purely circular or elliptical in general, because the field of the proton is a pure 1 per r squared interaction that leads to closed orbits, either circular or elliptical. If the electron is supposed to cause this motion, there's going to be a force that's going to be responsible for this. And what can be acting on the electron if it's not the proton? Well, it can only be the electron itself. So what's acting on the electron is the self field of the electron. And the force that's responsible for this spiraling motion is the radiation reaction force, or the self force, acting on the electron produced by the electron. How are we supposed to understand this? Well, if we were dealing with a particle at rest or a particle moving uniformly with constant speed, and suppose I think my electron to be a perfect sphere for the sake of this argument. If I'm dealing, so if I'm looking in a situation in the rest frame of the electron, and if I'm dealing with the situation, so for inertial electrons, so suppose I have an electron that's at rest or moving uniformly with constant velocity, but I'm looking at it in the rest frame of the electron. This is a case where there would be no self force acting on the electron, because I only get self force if I have radiation being emitted, and that requires accelerated motion. If the particle, if the electron is moving uniformly, it's not emit radiation, and therefore there's no self force going to be acting on it. And that can be understood, because if you look at the electric field that would be produced by an electron at rest like this, assuming that it's a perfect sphere, well, it would be a perfectly isotropic electromagnetic field, well, electric field, that would be pointing uniformly, you know, isotropically in all possible directions. And the net force created by this electric field acting on the electron would average out to zero when you account for all the individual elements within the electron. So no self force can be understood here, because, you know, the electric field is isotropic around the electron, and therefore the force that it creates is zero. When we have an accelerated electron, the situation changes, because the distribution of field lines around the electron is distorted. The acceleration creates a distortion in the angular distribution of the electric field, and you find that in that case the distortion in fact acts coherently in one particular direction, and it's in that direction that the self force will act. So I'm not sure if I can draw this very well, but here's the here's the electron, and this would be, you know, the isotropic original distribution that we had before. But the actual electric field is actually distorted from that, and I forget which direction it goes, but let's pretend that the distortion is actually pulling the electric field a little bit coherently in one particular direction like that. It's a, you know, it's a very small effect. I mean, here it's a gross, the representation here is really beyond scale. But the point is that here we had a situation of no radiation reaction force. Here we do have a situation of non-zero radiation reaction force. And when you look at this detail, when you look at the, so we do have a force that's going to be acting in some particular direction coherently on the electron. And it's that force, when you plug in all the details, if you look at this very carefully, you find that it's this force that will be creating this inspired motion. It's the self force of the electron that does that. And you can also calculate that the work done at that force accounts for the dissipation in energy. So so the nice thing about this discussion is that when you look at it, at this situation from the point of view of the equations of motion, you don't need to think about global, well, you don't need to think a lot about global features. Whether or not you have radiation, whether or not, you know, you have radiation in the wave zone, is largely irrelevant, because when you follow the motion of the electron, you can do this purely locally and decide from purely local measurements whether the motion is circular or, you know, an inspiral. So that's the flat space-time situation. And where it gets interesting is how this translates in curve space time description. This being local, so the action of the self-electric field on the electron is something you can decide to be local. And that's a situation where the principle of equivalence should be able to give you some useful guidance. If you're going to be working in that situation over here where the charged particle seems to follow a geodesic, well, to a good approximation, you are following geodesic motion, and to a good approximation, you are in an inertial frame. And the principle of equivalence would tell you here that pure local considerations should be exactly the same here as they were up here. The fact that you have zero acceleration by following the geodesic motion, let's say that you have this, you know, to very accuracy, guarantees that locally, even in the curve space time, as default, you know, if you're moving with the electron, you're going to see this situation, not this situation. Locally, the field around the electron in this situation of curve space time following geodesic motion, the local field is perfectly isotropic around the electron. And the statement is that, according to the principle of equivalence, there's no radiation reaction force that's produced like this locally. And that's a true statement. The principle of equivalence is reliable here because that's the local question that we can ask. And the answer is, as we follow the geodesic motion, there's no locally produced radiation reaction force. But I've been saying those words, locally produced. There is still going to be a radiation reaction force because, as John pointed out, we do produce radiation. We do lose energy in that situation. This is a system that will emit electromagnetic waves. This is a system that will lose energy as the waves carry this energy out of infinity. So the motion cannot be truly geodesic. There must be some radiation reaction force acting on the electron. The key point is that it's not locally produced. It's not produced locally by a distortion of the local electric field around the particle. What's happening instead? Well, what's happening instead is that this electron is producing field lines, it's producing an electromagnetic field that's interacting with the space-time curvature. The field lines are very simple locally. They all, you know, they all look isotropic around the electron locally. But globally, you know, the field lines go out away from the particle to large distances. The field lines will be, I'm going to draw a picture that certainly doesn't look like the real situation because I'm not sure exactly how we draw the real situation. But the point is that here you would be tempted to, so if you were in flat space time, the isotropic field lines would continue to be isotropic, you know, arbitrarily far away from the particle. But here they cannot do that because there's space time curvature that, you know, does have a role to play in the shaping of the electromagnetic field. I mean, you're solving the Maxwell equations here for the E field and B field in curved space time. The black hole will have influence or the curvature of space-time, even if we were dealing here with the Earth or some, you know, some less condensed object, it would be an influence on the space-time curvature, from the space-time curvature on the shape of the field lines. So, for example, let's suppose that the field lines, you know, have to avoid, for, you know, for some reason, plunging into the black hole. That's not really the situation. But let's, you know, by this, you know, this aspect of the problem that says that local isotropy goes into a more complicated set of shape far away because of the influence of the space-time curvature. So the field lines are not simple. Field lines are not isotropic everywhere. And more importantly, the field lines will have to change with time as the particle is moving around. As the particle is moving around, it changes its position in space-time. The field lines will have to respond to that. How these field lines are distributed in space-time will change with time. So what are we saying here? We're saying that if we follow the motion of the electron to look at the situation locally, we don't see a time-changing electromagnetic field. But if we look at the situation more globally, we see that both field lines will interact in a dynamical way with the space-time curvature. Radiation will be produced. It's not, you know, originating immediately from the particle, but it's originating sort of from the global region where space-time curvature can be active. So radiation comes out of the system through this mechanism of feel like interacting with the space-time curvature. And this interaction is such that part of the radiation goes to infinity, but part of the radiation comes back. The field lines over here become dynamical, are dynamical, and the radiation that they produce goes in all possible directions, partly to infinity, but partly also in the direction of the electron. So if you look closely in the vicinity of the electron, you see this isotropic local field produced directly by the particle, but you see this incoming incoming electromagnetic wave that locally looks like a field that would come from some other source. But in fact, it's just the delayed action of the field produced here interacting with the space-time curvature and returning to the particle. And when you work it all out and you flesh out the details, you realize that this is what's producing the radiation reaction force. The field coming back interacts with the electron. It's an incoming wave that interacts with the electron, and it does exactly the right thing to produce the right radiation reaction force that will, in fact, make the particle deviate from geodesic motion and eventually make the electron plunge into the body. So the physics is very different, but the effect is the same. You do have radiation reaction force that in time, and it's a small effect, but in time, the particle will be taken away from geodesic motion through the action of that globally produced radiation reaction force. And as far as the particle is concerned, as far as local physics is concerned, it looks as if what's happening is that the electron is not producing its own force, the electron is getting force from this incoming electromagnetic wave that comes from some other direction. If you look at it only locally, you cannot distinguish this effect from an incoming electromagnetic wave that would be produced by some other process. But the distinction comes from the fact that, it's not any random incoming wave. It's the one that was produced by the electron in the first place. It just, has to do all of this. It has to interact with the space-time curvature, and it will come back here a little bit later. And it's going to bring information about states, about what was going on to the state of the motion of the electron a little bit earlier. But it does exactly the right thing, and it will produce this deviation from geodesic motion. And in fact, you can figure out by working out all the details that the work done for this radiation reaction force will match the energy radiated away if it will be energy balance argument. So it's rather a beautiful picture. The details are horrendous. But the details tell you that, unlike the situation in electromagnetism, in flat space electromagnetism, where the radiation reaction force depends only on the state of motion of the particle right now, here the radiation reaction force depends not only on what's happening now, it depends on the past history of the particle. There is a delayed action because the radiation, the field lines have to go out and come back. The radiation has to come back to the particle, and it can come back from close. Close by, but it can come back mostly from a large distance. And in principle, the entire past history breaks dependence. There's dependence on the entire past history, a particle on the radiation magnitude. So it's a very formidable object to construct. It's constructed only implicitly in terms of global Green's functions and things like that, but it has all type properties and make it really fully explain what's going on. But I find extremely interesting about all this. And I, part of my research work is been doing this not for electromagnetic waves, but for gravitational waves, because it's the same story more or less. What I find fascinating is the fact that local physics, in this case, and local physics in flat space time are very different, and that's required from the principle of equivalence. All right. So I think I said what I had to say. So you had some care.
Misleading me or confusing me, but when we talk about self-forces, you're sort of talking about like singularities and issues for the particle acting on itself and this sort of thing. But it seems here, at least from the picture, and that's what I think is confusing me, that the force doesn't, like I don't see a singular jet arising from here, because it's as if the force is acting at somewhere totally different than the actual particle is. So how does there be singularity issue?
There's only a singularity issue here if you actually insist that the electrons should be treated as a point. If you don't do that, and if you just model get on that, my little sphere with finite extension, then take a few years, make it just fine everywhere, and you don't have to think about it or worry about the aggregates. If you do insist in take the limit where the sphere shrinks down to a point, then you're going to be dealing with a divergent field. But that's okay because it still has trouble. The distortion that you introduce here by letting the charge accelerate is finite.
The original field pattern is infinite, and when you remove this, what you pick up for the difference is actually finite, and it's that finite distortion that's responsible for the radiation reaction force, which is perfectly finite, well-defined, perfectly smooth force field. So the singular aspects of the problem are, a source of technical difficulty and confusion and all that stuff, but they're really not the central part of the story. The radiation reaction force is finite in this case, and it's finite in the opposite case. Here we understand even better why it's finite, because it's just an action of an incoming wave. John?
Even in flat space time, you can see it. You can see radiation reaction at a sort of non-local because it's that third derivative, right? There's a little bit of that nature even in flat space time. But
just to add to this, I was wrong in
suggesting that the radiation reaction forces are purely local construct because you need to impose outgoing wave finding conditions on your solution. So you are choosing the retarded solution over the advanced solution, for example. So you are imposing the correct asymptotic conditions to get the correct force that dissipates energy as opposed to do the opposite. So there is a global aspect of the problem, but the force itself is a locally applied force. So you're going to see something.
Yeah, it's the shield from radiation. I build big box, conducting box, I catch a perfect conductor,
right.
Radiation gets in. Now suppose I put myself and the electron inside one of the perfectly conducting boxes. Now it will still rate, naively in any case, the whole gadget and that charge there is still going to radiate, okay? But as I sit inside box, my local physics tells me, well, quick coming radiation here to that perfect conductor.
Right.
So what happens?
Well, that's going to take the first pleasure at producing harder and harder
some problems like that. I think here you would have to include details of how the box, so the conductive material on the box, would have the ability of, producing charge polarization and all of that, and I think you would have to include those details. And you would find that probably the interaction between the dynamical field with the polarized charge on the box would probably do the right thing to take the box on the same trajectory that the electron would take. So I think in this picture, the force is acting on the box, it's not acting on the electron directly.
I would be following the electron, which would not be following G6 reasonably. So if I did some experiments with other kinds of non-charged particles, wouldn't I see an acceleration? So here I am inside that box.
And the electron continues to move on to G6 because
it's not where the box is being acted on, but the box itself is doing the right thing. And I think you'd be conducting local experiments and noticing that you're being accelerated for some unknown reasons.
I'm just seeing that my pace is not a free fall.
Right. And not knowing what's going on outside the box, you would have to conclude that some force, mysterious force, is acting on you. And again, so the principle of equivalence perhaps lead you to think something. I think you could get a way out by saying that if you thought you were yourself in a free fall frame, but in fact you're not some external agent was conspiring to push you just accelerated fracturing that would just be your way out of that. Right.
That's the part. Yeah. Okay, other questions before we move on to other topics? Okay, so I enjoyed that. I think you did too. Okay, so I want to go back to what we were doing last week and go back to happy surfaces. So let me just, refresh our collective memory on this. So on this board, I'll write down what I wrote down before, and that's going to cover the case where the happy surface is either time-like or space-like. And on the next board, what I'll do is to, revise that when we need to think about the null case. And I'll talk about these interesting subtleties that we've met before that occur when you go from the time-like case to the null case. All right, so let's talk about time-like or a space-like surface here. So here's the hypersurface, and if we look at this as a space-time diagram, this would be a space-like surface. And there's going to be two ways of describing mathematically the hypersurface. One would be to say that the surface is defined by putting a constraint on the space-time coordinates, saying that the surface is described by some mathematical function that happens to be zero if you live on a hypersurface. Or another way of describing the surface would be to give parametric descriptions of curves that live on the surface. And those are the embedding relations that I mentioned before. So those dashed lines over here are meant to be curves of constant y. Y would be the coordinates that you would place on a hypersurface. Three-dimensional coordinates that you place on a hypersurface. And this equation right here would describe, each curve of constant y. And they're not like this. From this equation, we get to calculate the normal vector very easily by just saying that the normal vector is going to be proportional to the gradient of that potential, function phi. And what we would choose to do in this case is to normalize the normal vector by saying that that the squared norm of the normal would be either +1 or -1. So if the hypersurface is space-like like this, the normal is time-like, and the norm of the time-like vector would be -1. If the surface is time-like, the normal would be space-like, and then the squared, the length of that vector would be positive, the squared length of the vector would be positive. So epsilon is just notation for +1 depending on the signature of the normal or the signature of the hypersurface. And those embedding relations allow us to define vectors that are tangent to the hypersurface. And those we get by simply differentiating the embedding relations with respect to each one of the intrinsic coordinates. So the picture is that we have a normal vector pointing out of the surface, and we have tangent vectors pointing in the directions of the curves. So this would be E alpha 1, E alpha 2. And we find, of course, that normal vector is orthogonal to the tangent vectors. And we also have that the inner products between all the tangent vectors give us an induced metric on the hypersurface. Because you can show, and we did that last time, that if you confine yourself to displacements that are purely on the hypersurface, then those can be expressed in terms of increments in the y coordinates, and the equation looks like this. So you can go from the space-time metric, you can pull it back to the hypersurface. That defines the induced metric of the hypersurface. And can, you know, show that this is actually a metric by, you know, going back to the four-dimensional space-time element, and then restricting your displacements to be purely on the hypersurface. A little bit later on, we're going to be talking about surface elements, putting the surface element on the hypersurface, and obviously the metric here is going to be involved. We're going to use the metric term of that metric to define surface elements on the hypersurface. Okay, so all of that we've done before, but now I want you to look, you know, more closely at the null case. So everything that I've said here, you know, carries over almost directly to the null case. I don't need to change very much, but I'll need to make some little, you know, changes, some adapt some of the things here. Because for one thing, for example, there's no way I can impose this normalization condition on the normal vector when the normal vector is a null vector. So in the null case, we have some of these. So I'll draw the null hypersurface more or less similar to the other case. We still have the description that the null hypersurface can be described by an equation of this form. And we still have embedding relations that give us curves on the surface. But one, you know, one major distinction here is that, well, the normal vector we're going to calculate from function phi is going to be null. So the normal vector, the hypersurface, which I can just choose to be, I think in notes I put a minus sign here for technical reasons. I don't need to think about, you know, imposing a normalization condition on K because we have a situation where we're dealing with the null vector, and therefore the normalization of that vector is pretty much arbitrary. So I can just say that, unlike this case here, where I have to put in something in front to guarantee the normalization of the normal, here I need to put something in front here. I can just assign, you know, so put strict equality there, because the norm of the vector is zero. So that's a situation where, as you take the limit, the normal vector becomes increasingly tilted downward, and in the limit, the normal vector is actually lying within the hypersurface. We talked about that many times before. So now, instead of having a normal vector that sticks out of the hypersurface, it's, you know, it's tangential to the hypersurface. The normal is tangential. K is orthogonal to itself, and, you know, that's what happens when you deal with null situations. So here, what we have is a situation that K is going to be within the hypersurface. And K, as I'm going to prove in a second, but you, I think you already know that's true, K is going to be tangent to a network of null geodesics that are going to be lying in the hypersurface. So I can draw the curves, which are a little bit different from what we had in mind before, because here the curves were completely arbitrary. I put an arbitrary coordinate system on my hypersurface, and I'm just drawing the curves of constant coordinates. Here we have a set of preferred curves that are given by the geodesics to which K is tangent. And we're going to use those curves to our advantage to sort of, you know, come up with perhaps a preferred coordinate system on the hypersurface. So we have the null geodesics, and we have that K is tangent to those, and K, well, is at once normal and tangent to the hypersurface. We can still choose coordinates arbitrarily on the hypersurface, but that need not change. What I'm going to do a little bit later, you know, in just a moment, is to you know, specify a choice that's well suited to the description of those curves. But, you know, to begin, we consider the four displacement ahead surface as being arbitrary, and we still have embedded relations like that, and we still have the tangential vectors defined in this way. So those embedded relations still give us a set of tangential vectors. But again, dealing with, you know, and we still have the condition that tangential vectors are orthogonal in the space-time sense to the normal vector. But, you know, that's an issue that we encountered before. This condition right here doesn't guarantee that the tangent, you know, that one of these could not be in the direction of k, or that each one of these could have a component along k. And what we would like to do is to, you know, deal with that more or less in the same way that we dealt with that before. So one way of, so you know, we're all aware of this sort of situation that arises. In this condition does not rule out a possible component along k for each one of those vectors right here. And what I would like to do is to try to find a way to, well, make that happen. And that's possible if I actually think of using the curves as, you know, as a way to define the sort of favored coordinate system on the null hypersurface. And what I'm going to do is to do something like this. I'm going to sort of repeat here the construction that we made for the null congruences. Remember, we were given a congruence of null geodesics. We have here, and what we drew, what we did was to draw cross curves that were orthogonal to the null geodesics, and then we had this notion of transverse vectors in the case of congruences, but we'll have here also. So what I'm going to do is to start with those preferred curves, the null geodesics. I'm going to draw cross curves. And what I'm going to do is to use the geodesics and the cross curves as a way of setting up a useful coordinate system on the hypersurface. When I do this, I make a choice. I'm losing generality, but it's actually a good idea for all sorts of purposes. You don't need to do that. And, you know, you can deal with null hypersurfaces without doing that, but I find it very useful to do that. So here we have the cross curves, and what I'm going to say is that, well, one of my coordinates is going to be the assigned parameter that's running along, or the parameter that runs along the curves. I don't want to guarantee that it's an affine parameter, and I'm, you know, in general, in all generality, this definition here will not guarantee that the parameter is affine. I'll come back to that in a second. But I'm going to use lambda as one of my coordinates, the parameter that runs along the curve, each one of the curves as one of my coordinates. And then I'll use two other coordinates that are going to be things that will be constant on the null geodesics. And I'm just essentially repeating the construction that we did before in the case of congruences. We had, you know, one coordinate running along the curve, and we had another parameter running along the cross curves, and each geodesic was such that this second coordinate was a constant. Here I'm doing the same. So I'm saying that the generators of the null hypersurface are parameterized by lambda and labeled by two coordinates. Here I'm stressing one dimension, so it looks as if we only have one cross direction, but in fact we have two cross directions. The surface is going to be probably, you know, three-dimensional in the topological sense. So it's going to be labeled by two parameters that I'll call, well, theta 2 and theta 3, and collectively I'll denote them theta A with an index uppercase A that will run over the values 2 and 3. So what we have to see here is that we have parameter running along the curve, and then each curve is such that theta A is constant on the curve. The description of this whole network of curves is going to be where X alpha is going to, so the position of each curve is going to be such that is going to be a function of the running parameter lambda and a function of the labels theta t. If I keep theta t constant, I'm moving along the curve, and I move along the curve by letting lambda vary. If I keep lambda fixed, and I change the curve labels, I'm going along the cross curves. And that's how I can move on the hypersurface. I move either in the direction of the null GD6 or the cross GD6 along the cross curves. And, you know, allowing for the extra dimension that I can't draw, I can move either this way or that way, which means I can move either along theta 2 or theta 3. Okay. And having this mathematical description of the curves and comparing with that, which is the description of a bunch of arbitrary curves on the hypersurface, I can just make the choice that instead of choosing arbitrary coordinates y, a to describe my surface, I'm going to stick with those coordinates right here, which are well adapted to the behavior of the null generator. So we're going to choose the coordinates y, a as lambda and theta, a, the null geodesic parameter and then the labels on the GD6 as preferred coordinates. And these are well adapted to the generators. They will give me a very simple description of null generators. If theta is constant, that means that I'm moving along one generator. If theta is not constant, that means that I'm moving across generators. And you can, you know, picture that, well, like this, or better in my head, you can reinstate the third dimension in your head. Okay. If we do this, then we're still going to have those tangent vectors over here. But now they could be specialized to the specialist coordinate system. Having made that choice, we're going to have a tangent vector that's going to be corresponding to this coordinate, and a tangent vector that's two tangent vectors corresponding to the other two coordinates. So the first tangent vector that we're going to get is going to be this one, where you take derivatives of those embedding relations with respect to lambda, keeping the other two coordinates fixed. And we had another name for that vector before. Can you tell me what it is?
Here I'm calling it something else because it was an allocation. I'm taking a derivative with respect to the parameter lambda,
keeping the geodesic label constant. That means that I'm moving from one geodesic and staying at that geodesic. Right. But lambda being the parameter associated with k, it's not only parallel, it's actually equal. So what I should have said is that having defined k up here, that a displacement along the GDZ is going to be k alpha times an increment insert parameter. The choice of parameter is dictated by this definition. And that's the parameter that I'm using here. So this is a displacement on a given GDZ. So one of my tangent vectors, well, that's exactly what I said might happen before. We still have the condition being true for all the tangent vectors. This does not rule out that each one of those tangent vectors could have a component along k. And sure enough, the first one that I get is directly equal to k. But that's fine. It's not too surprising that the normal being orthogonal to itself, being tangential, that one of my tangential vectors should, in fact, could in fact be aligned with k, and that turns out to be a convenient choice. So we have this tangent vector, and we're going to have the one corresponding to the other partial derivatives, where you differentiate with respect to the curve label, but you keep lambda fixed. And when you do that, that means that you're not moving along the geodesic, you're moving along the cross curves. So you're keeping lambda fixed as you introduce the motion. So the cross curves will be connecting points on each geodesic with equal values of lambda. And by going along the cross curve like this or like that, you're moving from one generator to another generator, and therefore you're moving in the direction of generator labels. So that's the meaning of those vectors. K is going to be moving, of course, in the direction of the flow, and here we're going across the flow. And of course, we still have the condition that says that K alpha, E alpha A, are to be orthogonal, well, in the usual space-time sense. Well, with those three vectors, I have a partial basis of vectors on my hypersurface. The only one that I'm missing is the one that I to have at the beginning, was the vector that sticks out of the hypersurface. So I'm still missing that vector. I had it before, because the normal was doing its proper job. But here I have that, so having identified three vectors, I can pick a fourth one. Now, having specified these vectors, the fourth one's going to be uniquely specified. And then I have some choice into making the specification, but I'm going to do what I did before. I'm going to introduce another null vector n that's going to be pointing out the hypersurface. So I've finished construction for the basis. So at the level of this diagram, we have k going that way. We have the e vectors going along the cross curves. And then what I'm going to do is to introduce an additional null direction that's going to be sticking out of the hypersurface. And this will be defined in exactly the same way we defined it before, having defined those vectors by laying out our coordinate grid on the hypersurface. We're going to complete the basis by introducing a third vector, a fourth vector, and alpha, and we're going to specify it uniquely by imposing four conditions on it. We're going to impose that an alpha be a null vector. We're going to choose that it be normalized in the usual way with respect to k, and then we're going to choose n to also be orthogonal to all of the cross vectors. And we have conditions, and therefore we have unique specification of the fourth vector. When we were dealing with congruences, we had more or less the same story, except that there we had only k, and we picked the n, and then we got the initial two vectors. Here the strategy is different, because I'm not starting just from the congruence, I'm actually starting from a null hypersurface. And given the hypersurface, and given a preferred coordinate system on it, we have a way of picking three vectors, and the fourth vector is then determined uniquely. So in this context, we don't have problems of ambiguity or non-uniqueness. Those occur in the context of congruence, if they don't occur here, because the strategy is really very different. Okay, so clearly the null case requires a little bit more work, but after you handle all of the interesting subtleties, the story more or less follows. So I want to do a couple more things. There's going to be a notion of induced metric on the null hypersurface that can work out. We're going to do that in a second. But first of all, I want to prove something that I only stated before. I mean, you won't think it's very surprising. I've been talking all along about this, network null geodesics on the hypersurface, so I want to prove that, it's really there, that we do, have a network of null geodesics. Again, we've done part of that work in the case of congruences, in the case where we had a congruence that was hypersurface orthogonal, so we have, a good expectation that this should be true, but I want to go through the proof because there are some interesting subtleties that are present here that we didn't have before. So I just want to go through a careful proof of the statement that we do have a network of null geodesics on our null hypersurface. And it's those geodesics that are called the generators of hypersurface. So we have a congruence of null geodesics on the hypersurface, and those geodesics are, and K is tangent to those. So what I need to prove is that K satisfies the geodesic equation. We know it's a null vector. We know that this vector will be tangent to some set of curves. What I want to prove is that those curves are not just random curves, they're actually true geodesics. So I want to calculate the acceleration vector associated with K, which is that. And I'm going to follow similar steps that we've seen before. I'm going to say that K, K is expressed as the gradient of the scalar function. Therefore, what we have over here is the double derivative of scalar function phi that multiplies, well, another gradient. We can interchange the order of the derivatives over here. And we can rewrite this as half phi beta, differentiated with respect to alpha. The temptation here is great to say this is zero, therefore the acceleration is zero. However, there's a subtlety. We were able to do that before because we had congruence that was defined everywhere in space-time. Here, the congruence is defined only on the hypersurface. I can guarantee that this is going to be zero on the hypersurface, but I can't guarantee that it's going to be zero off the hypersurface. And I need to worry a little bit about that. So let's worry a little bit about this. So the derivative in directions that are tangential to the surface can be set equal to zero. The problem there, it's the derivative that goes off the hypersurface that I have to worry about. Let's introduce the decomposition of that vector into the basis we just introduced. A alpha is going to have a component called minus k minus kappa in the direction of the vector n. That's just notation. It's going to have some other components in the direction of k. And it's going to have components in the direction of the two remaining vectors. So that's just writing a decomposition of A in all the positive directions that we get. How do we determine the coefficients? Well, we just work out the inner products. So to get kappa, minus kappa is going to be the, so let's work out the inner product between A and K. The inner product between K and N is minus 1, so this is kappa. So what is kappa? Well, we work it out, and we say that kappa is going to be I screwed up the notation. I want kappa to be something else. I want kappa to be here, and this I'll call minus k. So this is going to be minus kappa k. Sorry about that. But let's do that again. This inner product is going to be equal to a, and the inner product, I can evaluate it, is going to be the quantity that is zero on this type of surface differentiated in the direction of the generators. What is that? Zero. Because it's staying on the surface when I'm calculating this derivative, and the norm of k is zero everywhere on the hypersurface. So we don't have that. Let's do B. The end product between A and the tangential vectors, well, I get the zero, so I can get anything here. So the end product between K and A and E is zero, so I get plus B, and then the end product between, should have had the index here. I get the inner product between two of the, cross vector products. So this is some, positive number I have calculated right now. So, and this is all equal to the gradient of this in the direction of the B vector. And again, this is zero, so I don't care for those details over here, because this is the gradient of K in the direction, along the cross curves, and I'm still staying on the hypersurface when I'm calculating this derivative, and the result is zero. Those numbers are not going to be zeros, and therefore it guarantees that this B has to be zero, which means that the only possibility of having a non-zero acceleration vector is in that component right here. So let's focus on that now. What is the inner product between A and M? Well, according to our normalization of N relative to K, this is equal to plus kappa. And what we got here, a half, phi beta, differentiated this time in the direction of M. And that's this derivative that I cannot guarantee is going to be zero. Because phi is zero on the hypersurface, its value may change below or above, and therefore the derivative of its gradient is not going to be zero, and it's not going to be zero necessarily in the direction of M. Maybe it will be, but in order to decide on that, it's not enough to have information purely on the hypersurface. I need to know what happens, below and above. So this is something that may be zero, but I cannot guarantee that it will be zero. But that's fine. It's okay, because what I have is an acceleration vector, and I screwed up the notation again because it's minus kappa instead of being plus kappa, but that's okay. I have an equation for K, which is still Judy's equation. It's the Judy's equation in the generalized form, where we have something on the right hand side, which is proportional to the tangent vector. I don't care what the cap is, because this equation, in fact, tells me that we're dealing with geodesics. In general, we'll be dealing with geodesics that are not affine parameterized. So the lambda that I introduced before, that comes directly from this definition, that lambda may not be an affine parameter. But that's, if it is, it is. If it's not, it's not. We just deal with it. It will be a fine parameter if I can guarantee that kappa is zero, and this I will have to guarantee only if I can arrange for this derivative to be zero, which means that I'll need to have not just one type of surface, but a stack. And I'll need to organize things in such a way that as I move up and down in the stack, that the gradient of phi remains zero. So I have a whole stack of type of surfaces, which are all null, and phi is going to be a different constant on each one. But they're all going to be null hypersurfaces, and therefore the gradient is going to be zero, not just on one, but the whole stack. And if I have that, which is more than what I'm arguing for, if I have that, then I can guarantee that kappa will be zero, and I can guarantee that the parameterization will be affine. If I'm given one hypersurface, I can always imagine that I have a stack arranged for that. But this may or may not be necessary. Okay, so bottom bottom line is that, well, we have now a justification for the whole construction. We have, you know, we have justification. So the whole construction only relies on the fact that we have null curves here. But now we know for sure that those null curves are in fact QD6, which may or may not be a finite parameter. Okay, so before we get to just say a couple more things about how to construct the induced metric on an all-heavy surface once we've made this the selection of coordinates. Well, what's the induced metric? Well, here, as it was there, the induced metric is defined to be inner products between all the basis vectors. So just to refresh our mind about this, so displacements on sigma in general are described by, moving in space-time, but, you know, confining ourselves to the hypersurface, which means that when we change the space-time coordinates, we're changing them in a way that's consistent with the displacement that's purely on the hypersurface. And then calculate d s squared associated with those restricted displacements. Well, we're going to have the usual thing, except that dx alpha is going to be constrained to be that. And dx beta is going to be constrained to be something similar. And that's where we recognize that inner products between basis vectors are giving us the components of the induced metric. So having made this choice for the coordinate system, we can just work out the inner products and see what the induced metric looks like for that choice. So if we look at H lambda lambda, we get G alpha beta alpha lambda E alpha beta lambda. But this is just G alpha beta K alpha K beta, and this is zero. So one of my entries in the metric is going to be zero. H lambda A is going to be the inner product between E lambda and E A. And that's the inner product between K and E. And that's also zero. So those entries also are zero. The only non-zero entries is the one, are the ones that I get when I calculate the inner products of the two transfer vectors. And that's a 2x2 matrix. Those will be non-zero numbers. And I'll call those numbers sigma e. So in reality, even though we're dealing with a topological free surface, the metric of that surface is two-dimensional. That's a familiar theme. We encountered it again here. So the metric on the hypersurface is a two-dimensional metric. When we move along the generators, of course, we're not generating the space-time interval. We only generate the space-time interval when we move across the generators. And that's the situation we say. All right, so I think that's probably a good time to start. I'll just write down two more equations. I just want to write them out. I won't need them immediately, but that's something that will come back to us. That will need to come back a little bit later. Here, so in the time like this, we have a vectorial basis that's given by the normal vector and all the tangential vectors. And you can always use that basis to decompose vectors and tensors. And in particular, you can use the basis to write down the expression for the inverse metric on the hypersurface. And the inverse metric on the hypersurface is going to be, you know, partly longitudinal, or normal, I should say, and partly tangential. And HAP with the indices up like this is the inverse to HAP with the indices down. So HAB is the inverse to HAB. I'll claim it. I mean, you can work it out. You can verify that this is true by just making sure that all the inner products are satisfied between all kinds of vectors that, you know, that's what the metric is going to be given you. Or you can work out, you know, you can, so this is just the position of the inverse metric in terms of the basis that we're given. And, you know, there are lots of ways to establish this result, but it's pretty intuitive, I think, that you should have the component, you know, that should be written like this. And in fact, you know, with epsilon equal to minus one, this is more or less the specific position of the metric we saw before for congruences. You know, if n's timeline, it's exactly the same thing. If n's spacelike, you can still do the same thing, but you need the different sign in front of you. In time, in null case, we have a basis that is now, you know, consisting of k and the two e's. And in a similar fashion, you can break down, you can decompose vectors and tensors as we saw before using the basis. And in particular, you can write down an expression for the inverse metric in this case, in the null case, that looks like this. And in this case, you use plus or minus. And in this case, we have two null directions. So it'll look like this. And here we'll get the inverse of sigma multiplying the basis vectors. And sigma AB is the inverse of the 2x2 matrix sigma AB. So it's the 2x2 inverse of sigma AB. This expression for the metric in terms of the vector basis is called the completeness relation, because it does express the fact that the basis is complete. You have, you know, enough vectorial directions to define a complete basis. And it's the sort of thing that turns out to be useful in computation. So I don't think I'll have to do that very soon, but certainly next week I'll come back to that. And either in the null case or in the time-like case, I'll often invoke the completeness relation to re-express the metric in terms of, you know, the vectorial basis. It turns out to be useful in all sorts of different contexts. So I'll be doing that. That equation over here will be invoked not for a while, but we'll come back to that eventually when we talk about event horizons. I think we'll need to use that equation at some point. So I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of it, and that you know, you'll remember it if you are aware of it when we come back to that in due time. Okay, so I think that's enough for this morning. Any questions about any aspect of what we talked about? John?
Theta 2 and theta 3 in general, I suppose you had some original parameterization that null hypersurface in terms of, you know, the coordinates you weren't interested in. And
right.
You wanted to go to lambda and then find theta 2 and theta 3. Is that trivial on this one?
No.
Okay.
No. That's critical. So in a timeline case, we don't worry because today we just do it in the way we please. Here we say it would be very nice to be able to find the support system of that generator without going back to find it. Well, it's simple situations like 10 examples like have in the book, so it's very easy because you have certain symmetry. You know, it's pretty obvious, but in a generic situation, you would presumably be presented with phi, the function, you would be able to work out k. Having worked out k, you probably would be able to find that the parameter is under PDZIC, but then how you go about finding constant quantities on, you know, finding labels on the GDZIC, that would require some work. And I think in, you know, complicated, difficult problems, you may not be able to get that, but then you would have to go back to the more general framework where the fourth system of the model is free to choose. If you can find the supporting system, then all sorts of things simplify in other calculations. And that's going to be useful. course about structure of enterprise, and it turns out that I necessarily won't have, you know, I have to present details. I just need the, I just rely on instruction without having to necessarily go from a specific space-time to a specific coordinate system. So I don't need to know how to find it, I just need to know it exists. Yeah, so I think I'll stop. Okay, so yeah, Simon.
And then E, you can switch N and K. The adult conditions are still true, except the one where you have K as the gradient of the scalar. Now, if you find N as the gradient of the scalar, and would that vector surface be related to the that vector surface?
But it would be unrelated. And now if you install, you're talking about this half surface, this null half surface, that would be crossing this other null half surface. And K would be tangent to that one, N would be tangent to the other one. And you would have a two-dimensional intersection of the two that would be a surface, you know, that would be a surface of constant, well, that would be a two-dimensional surface that would be spanned by the theta A coordinates. So, well, that can happen, but you're looking at a very different situation. Here I'm only interested in one hypersurface. What you're telling me is that you're interested in.
No, because the N that you get certainly has no, you know, it's null, but there's no requirement that it be that be the hypersurface part. So you're sort of not making a statement. To that. So if you're presented with two surfaces, then add that. If you're presented with one surface and you look at the end vector, there's really no guarantee that that vector will be tangent to another surface.
Okay, so I'll see you
this afternoon.